for listening.
Thanks for coming back. This is episode number 4, and we're going to get into how orbs and tic-tac UFOs work, part 2. I want to talk a little bit about a couple things that have occurred. So we are climbing the ranks in the UK for science podcasts. Basically, right now, we are... earlier today, I checked, I'm sitting at number 40. I was 42. I came right out of the gate in the top 50, which was great. And now I spoke to my podcast server, and this podcast is now in the top 1% of all new podcasts worldwide. So, wow, just awesome, and thank you. Again, it's not total download numbers. It's basically, it is part of download numbers, but more so it's about coming out of the gate at the age of the podcast and the growth metrics and all that good stuff. So I'd like to just give a big shout out and a big thanks to everybody. It's so highly appreciated. So I'm going to do this one a little bit different. As I get more into the podcast, I'll evolve and I'll get a little better here and there. And so we're going to dispense with the swoosh today, and I'll just be able to talk to you. And, you know, as I have things that I have to say outside of the article, I'll just say them. Got some feedback that people didn't like that so much. So, you know, again, I'm not perfect and I'll evolve as we move along. So let's just go ahead and if you don't know it, on the website uapmax.com, you can go to the article that I'm referencing, and right now it's How Orbs and Tic-Tac UFOs Work, Part 2. I'll also put a link in the show notes. So again, I didn't know I could do that before, so I'm learning. You'll be able to just go click right through. So let's begin. In 1917, Nikola Tesla tried to create wireless electricity. The project worked on something called a Wardenclyffe tower. I'm not sure if it's Wardenclyffe or Wardenclyffe, but a Wardenclyffe tower. Tesla's work on the tower explored electrical transmission using radio frequency resonance to produce electrical energy through two coils to generate high-voltage, high-frequency currents. His experiments used near-field inductive and capacitive couplings. Near-field inductive is a short-range wireless physical layer that transmits a low-power, non-propagating magnetic field between devices. Capacitive couplings transmit power between two networks by displacing currents produced by the electrical fields. It didn't work, but the legacy has endured. In fact, not only has it lived on in the Tesla lore, it is posited that his work was destroyed by those who never wanted free power for all. Had Tesla been able to get further funding, funding that was withheld from the power elite, today we might have had this tech and might have saved countless lives, kept massive amounts of carbon emissions from entering our atmosphere, but it never came to pass. However, his resonant inductive coupling method is applied to our short-range wireless systems. So as a side note here, the reason I included that is because, as you'll see a little bit later on, there is an energy being directed at these craft. I use this as an analogy that even early on in our, I guess, our journey through the tech and I'd call it the tech world, we had somebody on Earth that thought about these things. There has been some theories put out there that across time, and if you think of time as something that is non-linear, meaning the past, the present, the future all exist at the same time, which I tend to believe, just because of how you can look at things that have transpired in the world. That is a completely different article and a completely different discussion for another day. But throughout history, there have been pioneers that are... startlingly good with their predictions. Like it's, I can think of one right off the top of my head, and it may sound silly to you, but when you think about all of the implications of what this person put down in writing and put into the zeitgeist, it's pretty amazing. Gene Roddenberry. I mean, this guy, I mean, his thought process for where technology was going to go, you know, you talk about back in the 60s, this guy bringing up some of this stuff. We've gotten to quite a bit of it. So either the technology tree is following his lead, meaning he's just inspired people to make these things, or he was just off the charts brilliant and able to see these things. Or could there have been somebody that contacted him from our distant future or from an alien point of view? And it goes back in time. You look back at you know, different people throughout history and what they've been able to achieve and what they've, I mean, Tesla is a good example. Either, you know, he ended up being driven insane by the end of his life. But, you know, when you go back and you look at some of these things and you look at some of these people across time, it's a pretty amazing thing. Maybe I'll put together an article that details the inventions and the things that people have done that were way ahead of their time. And I mean, some of these were hundreds of years, that like the Sibiru manuscript, when you go back and you look at the 3-stage rockets, and there's an article on the site about that. I mean, you're talking about, you know, the 1500s here. It's insane. All right, back to the article. This is part of the secret of how these UFOs fly. The big issue is that we really don't understand it. The first thing I want to talk about in this article is the statement about superheating the air with these laser systems. It is a direct contradiction to the cooling effect, and it wasn't explained well enough on my part, so this first part will explain that further. Then I'll go into the rest of how these UAPs and how they move. It's going to be a lot to digest, so I will do my best to explain in a way that is easier to understand. It took me a great deal of time and research to even understand how humans make use of lasers and the underlying tenets. I have spoken with several laser engineers and discussed the systems I am talking about that have been reverse engineered from UFOs. Once I got into some very deep discussion, I blew the minds of these folks. They are in contact with me on a regular basis, and I hope to introduce you to them soon. In fact, two of them are actively working on projects directly related to the information I gave them, and so far, there have been a couple revelations. We're not talking on coming off the cuff here. We're not talking about breakthrough revelations. We're talking about some things that they, how do I put this? We talked about specifically how these lasers were cooled, and they're looking into an elemental reaction. It's specifically with the creation. Again, this comes back down to helium a lot, but there's a reaction going on there. Okay, I will do my best to talk about them at a later time and introduce you to the tech they are trying to work on. It's that big. I will keep updating as I get that information. Once a couple things have fallen into line, I will have a, hopefully, big reveal. Before we move on, let's discuss the discrepancy with my explanation of superheating while not demonstrating a heat signature, which is very easy for us to detect. It would have to have an explanation beyond understanding, and to a point that that's correct. But not entirely. We understand the concept, though mainly theoretical to humans. The theory has to do with time dilation. When these crafts are hit with sensors, several things tend to occur. First, it seems that, at least with the local radar and sensor hits, they can be jammed. There are reports that locally, an in-flight signature can be seen, but when the crafts detect they are being sensed or targeted locally, they jam the contact or craft sensing them. All right, so there's a theory here that they're protecting themselves from the short, the short range possibility of being taken down. Now, this isn't necessarily something that works for every single time, and I don't have a I don't have an answer for that, because if you look at a lot of this is coming out now, the Alaska UFOs or UFO that was shot down. That obviously would have been a local targeting, right? So it comes in on radar, NORAD picks it up off long-range radar systems, and then they send out planes to intercept. Don't know if those were the Gansey technology or not. As I'm specifically talking and relating to the Gansey technology. There could be, you know, 30 other entities out there with technology that's similar. I it's just impossible for me to know. Nobody knows. Well, the people do know what it was, but they're not releasing that information. So the point that I'm trying to make is that not everything is going to be a Gansey technology, I can only speak for those orbs and Tic Tacs that my source had, you know, some contact with. So I don't know specifically if that was them or not. Okay, back. So, but it's not always true of distance radar. So maybe they are trying to locally, what that distance is, no idea, jam any possible threat. But they don't care if they're looked at from a distance for some reason. A little side note. So my thought and his thought, or my person's thought was, more than likely if it comes from a distance, they can just easily just get rid of it. But maybe if you're too close, they may not always have time to react, or they may not, I don't know. I mean, there's a deployment of systems, especially with the laser systems, that has to occur specifically with the orbs. There isn't necessarily that much of a system that is being deployed with the Tic Tacs. So it's a weird juxtaposition between the two. Why they aren't showing the radar a heat signature, I talked about a tiny bit, but it has to do with time dilation. So essentially, you're not seeing anything because it's either in the past or the future. You aren't seeing them as they are. You are seeing them as they were or will be. I know that's tough. It's outside the envelope of what we can understand, except in the quantum realm. That's when things like this can occur. The Gansey and probably other civilizations figured out how to scale the quantum realm. It's also part of the extra-dimensional theory, space-time warp, and portal theory. Some of the interactions that occur are difficult for me to understand, let alone explain. I've had to go back and forth talking to this person before because some make zero sense, and I'm simply not versed enough to fully grasp it. I can report on the knowledge, I can't explain it. And then I went on to give you a quote. If anybody says he can think about quantum problems without getting giddy, that only shows he has not understood the first thing about them. And that's Niels Bohr, and he's basically speaking about quantum mechanics and the quantum realm. Basically is, you know, his thought was, if you understand it, you probably don't understand it. The laser systems in use that create plasma and open doorways, remember, they do not work on the traditional model of how laser systems humans use. These are superheated, but the ones that actually create portals and Einstein-Rosen bridges, etc., those are cooled to ambient temperatures. Whatever the outside temperature is of the force field, same temp as the laser, so it'll look like it's not there. The laser works with vibration and wobble. It's doing something totally different than what we think of as a laser. Yes, it's superheated, but there's a process through the creation of that, for lack of a better term, universe that cools the laser and helps to create the vibration. Now, another little note. I was raked across the coals for saying, oh, you added a wobble to it. First of all, I didn't add a wobble to it. That's number one. Number two, the vibration and the wobble that we're talking about is basically what it's doing is it's somehow, and this is some of the, they, here's what happens. It gets so intense that even though we understand the process, we can't duplicate the process because we can't put the power to it, right? We can put enough power to it to take down a plane, to hit a boat, to I imagine they could probably do that to a human pretty badly. But we can't get to the point where we can open doorways and portals and things like that because we can't figure out how the power is getting to it. We understand the step-down system, and I'll talk to you about that in a little bit, but it's that external power. We can't duplicate it. It's coming from somewhere else. And they know it's being directed at the craft because it's a worldwide event. These things can operate in oceans, so it's going through the ocean. They can go into the atmosphere. They can go above the atmosphere into space, and it's still a functional system, but they just don't know how the heck it's working. Or they don't know where the power is coming from that's being directed at these things. It's so intense and so strong. And that's why I talked about Tesla at the beginning, because that power that is being generated to then power the systems inside is insanely vast. Like, we're talking about like the complete directed energy of a star, and we're not even seeing it, right? It's not even in our atmosphere. Well, it's in our atmosphere, obviously, but we're not seeing where it's coming from. We're not seeing the signature of it, but we know that it's there. So, you know, it's kind of like with dark matter and dark energy and all these other, we know it's there because we can see the pull. We can see the relation that it has in holding galaxies together. In fact, if the dark matter wasn't there, if the dark energy maybe wasn't there, galaxies would just fly away. It's their influence on the pull of gravity within these systems. That's what's holding things together. So we can't see it. We can see its effects, but we can't see it. And there's really a very good article that recently came out that talks about how things in space are using vibration and wobbles to hold things together, to make them cohesive, to make them function. So what the theory is that at some level, this system is using the same mechanics that the universe uses to keep things coalesced, to keep them together. We don't know what that is. And we may be so far away from that that we don't understand it, because there's a theory that it's being driven from other dimensions. So if you don't know what these other dimensions are and you can't pull from them, and we're how far away from them right now are we from finding out, figuring out that technology? We're at a standstill. We can use and operate the systems within. So we can, as I said, we can use those laser systems. It's not a problem. We can put our own power to it. And you know, I suppose if you wanted to get to the point of being like some, you know, crazed, you know, dictator, and we want to put, you know, the total combined output of a nuclear power plant directly into this system, you know, maybe you'd be able to do something bigger with it. But that's not practical. So let's get back. Went off on a little tangent there. The laser goes through the tiny universe-like creation. That beam is cooled to negative 454.811 and then all the way down degrees. The plasma reaction, I'll go into that deeper, is then quote-unquote lit, so to speak. Again, this is through a very fast system. It's almost like a Van de Graaff generator, kind of. It doesn't have a little ball with, you know, sparks shooting out of it. It's not that. It goes through that, and it's electrically charged to go through that, so it lights it up. And then the field is created. The field itself is ambient temperature, not the beam, but the beam is created within the field. The field is ambient, and it can show itself in any way to anything looking at it, because it's going through, yes, it gets cooled, but then the field that's around it, the field that the craft has created, is ambient. Okay, there's no net energy pulled from the air, or rather, there's no net energy between the energy that it seeks. Let's say it's going through the air, and you would get friction. And it's the same with magnetics, like, right? When you go through, magnets get hot, and it's because they're using their power, the charge that they have, or the negative and positive charge that they have, they get hot, right? But this system, it has a net energy, zero net energy loss or gain. So it's something that is, the field itself is creating that ambient temp. So you're not going to see anything, even if it goes through it, because A, it's been cooled, and B, once it hits the field, it's at ambient temperature. So yes, the beam is super hot, like insanely hot, but that field is what cools it down with that tiny universe. And again, it's a tiny universe is the lack of a better explanation. So, but the beam is created within the field. The field is ambient and can show itself in any way to anything looking at it. If I were to simplify it even more, we don't have the stuff to see it. But even if we did, it wouldn't matter. The field is porous in one direction, allowing the beam to go through and interact with whatever it is targeting, and is within the field in any case. Now we'll get a bit deeper into the infographic. And again, if you go to the article, this just brilliant infographic here that I made is there for you. Let's first start with the really high tech, really incredible infographic I have diligently and exactingly recreated for you. The first part of the explanation is within the arrow pointing to number 4. This is a feat of engineering that is, to put it mildly, one of the most incredible parts of the entire system. Coupled with the laser systems discussed in part 1 of this series, this is the part of the craft that powers the laser system. It is an antimatter collection chamber. Arrow 1 is a discharge mechanism that works for both the laser system activation as well as the bubble creation for the craft that creates the plasma field and the overall operation of the entire craft. The antimatter collection chamber creates, collects, and annihilates matter in this one system. It contains within the small system a collider that creates the reaction that then creates the antimatter. The antimatter is then collected and used as necessary to create a reaction for the laser systems, but more so, the system is used to control the crafts themselves through a process that creates a literal magnetar-like field around the craft. There is a mix of liquid helium, which in Article 1 was explained. Additional elements can be pulled from the atmosphere as well as the vacuum of space and applied to the necessary systems within either the orb or the Tic Tac. So if you remember correctly, or if you remember in the first article, and if you go back to the lasers articles, there's two different laser systems. The first system is a lower powered system, but it does a lot of different things. It scans, it can pull elements, it can mine, it can do all these things, right? And what this system does at the kind of end of the day, if we break it down into everything, and I believe probably what its most important role is number 1, scanning, and number 2, collection. So it's able to somehow, well, it's not somehow, we've figured it out. I don't understand the exact everything behind it, but I know the Chinese are ahead of the United States in this, but they can pull things directly out of rock, out of the air, out of the water, and break it down to its basest elements, or collect it and put it to its largest element. So if you're pulling gold, let's say, for example, it can pull it out and it's pulling that raw gold. Obviously, there's still work to be done to bring that gold down. I don't think it just pulls it out and all of a sudden you have, you know, 99.99% pure gold. There's still, I believe, I don't know this for sure, but I mean, there's a process that has to go on, a smelting process that has to go on to make that better. And that's what they do somewhere else. They're not doing it on board. So let's get deeper into the creation of the antimatter and how it is collected. The creation of antimatter is so fast and so violent, it needed the creation of the magnetar-like field to contain it. The containment system is about the size of a softball. Around this softball, the collider is activated. This is where we don't know where the power is being grabbed from. So this very small collider, which seems like, okay, that doesn't make sense because you need a huge collider in order to make these reactions. Apparently you do not. I don't know the theory behind it. Thought process is they've been able to just basically scale up or down anything that they need to. And I suppose that if you're able to manipulate the universe at the level that they're able to, they figured something out. There's a theory, and this goes back to science fiction again. So there's a theory that things like Doctor Who, the TARDIS, right? It's a telephone booth. But when you go inside, it's massive. There's a theory that, and they can't, that they're unable to, A, duplicate it because they don't have the power to do it, as I said. But also that there's a theory that maybe this thing is massive. Maybe it's the size of, maybe it goes around the moon or something like that, you know, a collider that it, but it's somehow delivered within this system from somewhere else. Could be another dimension, could be something else, but it's delivering the actual material and the actual thing that's happening, whatever the process is that's happening, it's happening somewhere else, but then it's sent to this containment system because they can't, they know what it is, right? The scientists that are looking at this and the physicists that are looking at this go, oh, yeah, that's what that is. But it could have other properties as well that we don't know. None of them, to my knowledge, have been opened up inside It's just the known characteristics of what they're looking at. So something external creates a massive amount of energy that is both creating and throttling that energy to this antimatter system. Now, part of this also, there's less throttling from the outside going on. In fact, they don't think there's any throttling from the outside going on. It's just being directed. Boom, it's got this massive amount of energy. It's hitting this thing, and then it goes into this system, and that's when it starts to step down. The container is created in a Myrigon shape. The outside is a simple titanium alloy, and the inside is something credible. The field generated within the 10,000 side object is lined with an incredibly thin layer of magnets that are polarized in their opposite configuration in its obverse position. This means every single facet contains a perfectly directed positive and negative force that allows the antimatter dumped into the object to remain stable and not come into contact with matter until such time as it is expelled into a magnetized chamber and used for the creation of energy needed to power the systems that need the specified amount of power to work the lasers and the movement of the craft, which is not propelled, but pulled. Phew, that's a lot. I told you this article was going to get technical. We haven't even gotten to the good stuff yet. So this small shape can be opened. It is the way that they explained it to me, this person explained it to me, is you pull it apart, right? And it can be removed rather easily for some reason because of the fields that are put to it are so magnetic. But the electromagnetic charge inside does not occur. There are magnets inside, but the actual strength of that magnet does not get, I guess, switched on is the best way to put this, until power is put to it. And then, obviously, you can't move it. In fact, they can't even turn this field on while they're in front of it or near it or put power to it. It's too great. It would actually kill you. And I'll get into that in a little bit. Now, we have this system that is creating, storing, and distributing a massive amount of energy. And the crazy part is that it doesn't compare to the amount of energy being directed at the craft from somewhere else. So as you see, we're going to have to step that power down. It's like a rheostat almost. The ongoing theory is that the energy needed to create the reaction and the creation of the antimatter is an order of magnitudes greater than the energy created by antimatter systems. The antimatter systems. In other words, there is something like with the combined output of the energy of an entire star, think our sun, that is directed towards the craft anywhere within our planetary system. I'll try to reduce that further. Somewhere in our solar system or even beyond lies a source of power so great that these crafts are able to receive it anywhere on our planet or solar system, or even beyond the power systems necessary to create the incredible feats these crafts exhibit. What the hell is it? We have no idea. The tech itself is made from Earth materials and then combined here on Earth through processes we haven't discovered yet, but aren't so far outside our technical envelope we won't get there for a couple hundred years. And I keep harping on this and harping on this and harping on this. Nothing that we're seeing from a point of view of a technical creation is beyond us from a couple hundred years. It's the stuff that's happening outside of that, with the exception of one piece of the system, by the way, which I'll get to in a second. What's happening outside of our domain, and when I say our domain, I say planet. But it may not be, because if it's interdimensional, it's right here. It's all around you. The difference is that we don't know how to get there. That's part of the problem of you know, you have to learn and you have to take those steps before they're given to you. Because if you're given the amount of power that this system seems to be able to or is seemingly taking in, and even at the smallest size of these craft, they're still pulling in this amount of power. If you take that power and you give it to us humans who are out here messing around, you know, we got wars here, we got this here, we got this here. Are you going to trust that creature to not use that power? Look at what we're already doing. We're already taking these systems and we're putting them into offensive laser systems, right? We're not going to be given technology that could blow up a whole planet or more. It's just not going to happen. We need to get there naturally. The theory is that they are harnessing the energy of either a massive star and it can send throughout the universe, possibly through the network of connected worlds we are just now discovering with the James Webb Telescope, or through interdimensional or wormhole pathways. The UFO can receive this energy anywhere, so it makes more sense, at least from a human point of view. The network the energy is traveling through is sent via the network of interconnected worlds. It is just the energy being directed, not the heat or strong nuclear force. Additionally, it was discovered that the massive magnetic fields being generated by the softball-sized Myragon also repel quarks and neutrinos. In quantum physics, there are up quarks, down quarks, and strange quarks. Each has its own physical property. With neutrinos, they are part of the weak nuclear force and interact only through the weak force and gravity. About 100 trillion neutrinos pass through you every second. In fact, these things can pass through our conventional containment systems for antimatter, and though they don't seem to impact the antimatter we have created here on Earth through the CERN supercollider, they are weak nuclear force. We have no idea how they would interact with antimatter or with matter in higher dimensions. I made a mistake there. It should have been interact with matter, not antimatter, in higher dimensions. The fact that the Myragon does not even allow those neutrinos, though, may be a clue as to how this creation and containment system works at higher dimensions. We can't get to those dimensions, so we don't know. So basically what I mean is this. In a higher dimension, will a neutrino interact with matter? If it does, and you're creating antimatter, or if at the higher dimension the neutrino becomes a, let's say it becomes a more stable piece of matter, and again, some of this I don't understand, so if there's a physicist out there that would like to correct me on this, that's fine, but the theory that he had, that this person had, and I kind of believe and understand it, is let's say you get into a higher dimension, and now, because these neutrinos are everywhere, so they must be important at some level, right? There must be something going on within our universe, and when you include dimensions, dimensions are part of the universe, so maybe they're more active at a higher dimension. Maybe they're there for a reason at a higher dimension. So the fact that this ball, or softball, I guess I'll say, is able to repel the neutrinos, could it be that at a higher dimension, those neutrinos would interact with antimatter and matter? And so at that point, the collision and the annihilation that occurs would occur automatically and blow the system up. So maybe that's some type of a clue as to interaction between neutrinos and matter and in neutrinos and antimatter at a later stage or at a higher stage of dimension. I know that's a lot to take in, and I'm probably not explaining it perfectly, but that's just kind of the thought process that we had that we were discussing. And these are the processes. Now, keep in mind, this is only to the power that we as humans can add to the system. So as we test these systems, and we can test these systems, we can see what's occurring. We can't see what's occurring once you add all that massive power to it. So let's move to the discharge system. Number four feeds number one. Number one is a fiber optic and magneto system that directs the energy dumped into it from the antimatter chamber. So here's what happens. Typically, a magneto is a generator of energy. In this case, magneto is being used because it is most like the properties of this system and contains, yes, more magnets. It is more like an alternator, and it contains a commutator that moves so fast it's near the speed of light. The material itself is entirely unknown. We can't penetrate the structure in under electron microscopy. It has no structure that can be seen. It is smooth and contains nothing but color. It is grayish and it has a sheen like an oyster shell, the inside, I should say. They can't crack it, and nothing they have hit it with will put a scratch at any level, including the atomic level. It is one of the very few pieces of tech they simply can't figure out, and it is so strong there is nothing else that compares to it. It is referred to as the thing. The system then sends energy through switches and pathways and is able to be dialed into a trickle you could touch with your bare hand, all the way to power so massive that it can manipulate gravity. Anti-gravity. But that's only one part of it. Coupled with the anti-gravity, the most fantastic part of this entire thing, these crafts are turned into magnetar-like objects that can use the magnetic field of our Earth to pull themselves. They can move anywhere within our three-dimensional world with ease. Let's discuss the outer skin and inner skin. Coupled between the two layers is liquid helium, specifically helium-2, which is a superfluid. Liquid helium has a zero viscosity property, and while it's in its 2 form, acts as a superfluid. A superfluid moves without any loss of kinetic energy. The helium is then infused with neodymium magnets, ground to a powder, and electrically bonded with the liquid helium. As the crafts move through our world, a massive electrical charge is applied to the outer hull, which then moves in any pattern it needs, at speeds that are instant, stops that are instant, and don't affect the interior of the second skin. So as the outer skin is pulled by the fields it is navigating, it moves so fast and glides so fast, the interior doesn't react. So as an aside, it doesn't have time to react. It's too fast. It remains stationary. Let me back up. Think about it like you have glasses on a table. You take a piece of, you take the tablecloth, you yank the tablecloth out, and everything stands, right? Same principle. It remains stationary without a superstructure between the two skins. The interior maintains a persistent gyroscopic-like position. The only time it changes in the case of these crafts not configured, tic-tacs, possibly disc in a perfect sphere. Then there is part 2 and part 3, a seat with a gyroscopic mechanism allows the occupant or occupants to travel in a perfect position without any external gravity or movement. There are no control systems inside, prompting the team to believe these are either automatically controlled and the occupants are just there for the ride, or they can control anything, everything by mind. There's certainly maybe other theories there as well. Maybe they have systems that when they walk in, kind of like a race car driver has a steering wheel that he puts on when he gets in the car. That could be happening as well. Again, some of these things are completely theoretical. We just don't know how some of them work. We can look at the physical object of whatever is in front of us, and we have some pretty smart people out there that can figure out what's going on. I mean, we have brilliant engineers, we have brilliant physicists. We have some amazing people on this planet that can figure things out. But at the end of the day, some of these theories that I'm putting out there are not 100%. They're based upon what they believe is happening through what they can test. They have definitive answers for. But even like when I'm talking about some of these things, we can't apply the right amount of power to it. So that's when it becomes theoretical. That's when it becomes, okay, so the best guess that we have for what is occurring here is this, this, and this, right? It's not, understand that as I say these and I describe these systems and I talk about these systems, some of them are exact, like they know exactly what's going on. Some of it is supposition and some of it is thought about, well, there's got to be a level of extra dimensionality here. It has to be because it's the only way they could explain these things. And all the math and all the physics and all the, they all say that there is math that fits other dimensions, that it's there, right? These dimensions are there. I don't know how many other there are, but they're there. We just don't know how to see them. We don't know how to get there yet. And we will, as long as we don't blow ourselves up first, humans will get there. Well, maybe we'll have to be given that information. I don't know. Maybe that's how transfer of technology works across the universe. Maybe it's given. Maybe it's a learned environment for all the species. But you have to get there from a sociological point of view. And I'll tell you right now, I don't think we're there. Not from a sociological point of view. So let me make sure I get back to the system here. All right, so now we get to the simple explanation. The craft is hit externally by a huge power source. The craft reacts with a small collider. The collider makes antimatter and collects it and distributes it to the distribution and generation system. It sounds counterintuitive, but the generation system is acting like a step-down or step-up type system for energy. Then, the other systems are activated and combined with the lasers are able to operate in our space, open portals, bridges, wormholes. These systems seem to be able to be scaled up and down depending upon the needed size of the craft. That is why Because the orb UFOs, or this is why, because the orb UFOs don't contain the generation system, only the antimatter system. They can't open, you know, they can't open that long wormhole to the other side of the universe. They seem to be able to go only through portals or dimensions, and they don't seem to have the capability of wormhole travel. The way the UFOs work is this. They create an incredible magnetic field contained by the force field, for if it weren't, during operation, these crafts could literally pull the very atoms of every type of life apart at the atomic level, and then they are able to apply this magnetic field to the mode of travel they are going through and move like a ping pong ball, fly at unheard speeds, travel through portals, bridges, well, ER bridge is a wormhole, but portals, dimensionals, and wormholes. So I have to fix that. They can create or open these travel methods with ease. They can also do one other thing. They can be used offensively if needed. It's very scary. I wonder why the governments want to keep them secret. They make nukes look silly, and they wouldn't create a nuclear Armageddon. If you think about it, I'm going off the side here again. If you were to take one of these craft with its magnetic and or its offensive capability with the lasers at the level that they're able to use, you could destroy entire cities. You could enjoy, if you were able to get the entire power, you could enjoy destroy an entire planet. But I mean, it literally is the Star Killer, the Death Star. It really is, and you can see why a defense contractor or a government would want to keep that secret, because it's literally the most amazing offensive weapon. This is what we're talking about when they want to keep this secret. Because once you get out there what these things are capable of, humans immediately go, oh, you know what I could do with that? I mean, it's pervasive in American culture alone, and not even including all over the world. And listen, I'm a 2A advocate. But think about it. I mean, wouldn't you want to play with it? I would. I'd want to go play with this type of power and see what it did. Therein lies part of the problem, because you have people that in the guise of national security, or in the guise of we need these weapons, they're paranoid. And rightfully so. There's a lot of bad stuff that goes on in the world. But until we look at it as we shouldn't be thinking of it that way, and instead we should change our thought process for weapons, and instead say, well, why can't we use this for going to the stars and seeing other worlds and, you know, truly exploring. And there are plenty of those among us that would love to. I would love to do that. I'm sure there's many of you that would as well. But when the people in power are continuing down the roads that they're continuing down, we're not moving forward. It's just not. And I don't know how far away we are, but it's not going to happen. Essentially, these crafts are magnetar-like objects. They rely on both magnetic and anti-gravity principles, are capable of traveling through any medium on Earth and beyond. And I'll give this a little side. They can go right through mountains, right? Because they can open those portals. And a portal can go through anything. It's just, think of a portal as point A to point B. They plot it. They get there. They go through it. It doesn't matter what's in front of them. It literally doesn't touch them. It has nothing to do with it. The portal has already gone through. It goes right through. It's just like a neutrino. Oh, that was kind of a revelation there, wasn't it? Neutrinos can go through anything, and these things can go through anything. So at some point, we're talking about scalability here. One of my next articles is going to expand upon a few things related to these two articles. The first will focus on what happens after a laser activates a travel pathway. The next will delve into some further questions about the construction of the antimatter systems and the anti-gravity systems. I touched on them here, but I have a lot more to tell about these and can even give some real-world examples of how we can work some of these systems ourselves. The problem is we don't have the power to make them work, even if we build them. And we probably have built them. Hint. I will also touch on the probable source of this energy source, and we will discuss civilization types and harnessing entire stars. Humans have theorized about a Dyson sphere, which is wrong. It isn't needed when you can manipulate matter at the quantum level like these civilizations seem to be able to do with ease. It's all about black and white holes and the elusive dark energy. And yes, white holes exist. I will explain exactly how they beat thermodynamics. Hint. We thought nothing escapes a black hole. But suddenly, if you go to the article, you can click this. We have now found out that black holes expel energy. They expel matter. We found it. We were told before a week ago, 2 weeks ago, black holes, nothing can escape a black hole. Suddenly, we're finding out things escape black holes. White hole is the exact opposite of a black hole. It is a completely and totally theoretical concept within space that has never been, it's mathematically there, but we've never seen it. But we have. And I'm going to explain to you what was explained to me and what they figured out and what they found. So this, let me move my microphone here just a little bit. So this, let's see where we are right now. All right, we're 45 minutes in, and I could go for another 2 hours, but I made a promise to keep everything within, you know, a 30, 45 minute time frame so that these are easily digestible. So we're going to touch more on these a little bit in the future. There's a lot more to get to. If you haven't done so yet, could you please give us a 5-star or a like or a thumbs up? Mel, you're more than welcome to make comments. Any questions that I can answer, I'm on Twitter all the time. It's UFOs_UAPs, or you can just search for UAP Max on there and I'll pop up. But as you can see with this episode, I was very excited. I love the science behind these things. I love technology in general. And being able to get into this and learn about these things has been a mind blow for me. It really has. It's been one of the most exciting times of my life to learn about these things and to, oh, my dog sneezed. You might have heard that. And to know that these craft are out there and that we do have some knowledge of them. We're able to figure some of this stuff out. I mean, we're not a primitive species. We're certainly not at their level, but we're not primitive either. You know, one of the things I stated previously was, you know, we're kind of like ants to them. We're at the level, especially with the Ganzes, we're nothing compared to what they can do. And that's because of the technology that they have outside of this and where they are on the plane of existence, I guess, with the universe itself. So one thing that a really great analogy, somebody said, well, why would they think that we're ants? Or why would they think that we're this? You know, we're obviously a sentient being. We're obviously good for something. And I'm not saying that we're not. I'm saying that we're not special. It's a tough thing to handle. That's what they're talking about with ontological shock. To learn that your place in the world and the universe is really, really insignificant compared to the grand structure of everything is a very difficult thing to take, because we all have a little bit of ego, and we all have a little bit of, you know, hey, we're better than, and it works with races and religions, and it works with, you know, just ideology overall. And again, I don't want to get into a philosophical and, you know, big discussion about that, but if you think about it, you know, those are some of the reasons that, you know, we're not quite what we think we are in the grand scheme of things. But anyway, so back to the analogy. So this person said, you know, if we're, you know, I don't believe that the aliens would look at us that way. And I said, well, you know what? When you go to the forest, do you pay attention to the things that you're walking on? Are you paying attention to the ants that you're walking on? No, you're just kind of walking over them. Now, I'm not saying that you come to something and you see something like, you know, a small bug and you walk past it or whatever. I'm not saying that that doesn't occur. I'm saying that in the overall scheme of things, what I believe is going on and why I believe they're here to begin with, we're just here. We don't offer outside of, you know, an occasional annoyance. We don't really offer anything to them. But again, I believe there is you want to call it a prime directive. I think there is at some point a directive, that they're really not supposed to touch us, and why I believe, again, non-zenith intelligence, there's something above them keeping them in check. And I don't know what that is, but anyway, so I appreciate everybody, taking the time to listen. I'll ask you if you could leave some reviews and some stars. It's all of that helps. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to ask. I answer as many as I can. Sometimes I might miss one. I'm not ignoring you. It's just there's a lot going on. So until next time, thanks for listening. This has been Dear People of Earth, presented by UAVmax.com.
You just listened to the Dear People of Earth UFO and UAP podcast, presented by UAPmax.com. All rights reserved. No part of this broadcast may be reproduced or distributed without express written consent of the content creator. Thank you for listening.